say?
Blog Talk
yes.
Radio.
Good evening, everybody. This is Bonnie Kay and the Straight Wives Talk Show. And I'd like to welcome all of you tonight. This is the hard-hitting show that discusses the complexity of marriages between straight women to gay men. And each week, my co-host is Misty Hall, and I discuss issues that affect over 4 million women in this country and millions more around the world who find themselves unknowingly married to a gay or bisexual man. If you would like to call into our show, you're more than welcome. If you have any questions for our guests or for Misty or me, and our number here is area code 213. I'm sorry, that's the wrong area code. If you call that, you'll never get us. Try area code 646-716-4893. I'll mention that again, area code 646-716-4893. And Misty, how are you?
I'm doing well. How are you tonight?
I'm doing good. We're so happy that you're back. I told everybody you were traveling a little bit and that, you know, you'd be coming back this week. So I'm really excited you got back in time.
Just in
and
time.
Are you
barely
in the hills of Kentucky?
I'm sorry, didn't hear you.
I said, are you in the hills of Kentucky?
Yes, I'm back in the hills of Kentucky. My favorite.
And how's the weather there?
It's rainy right now, a little rain, but the leaves are changing. Get to enjoy the fall weather, the beautiful seasons that I don't get to enjoy in Florida, so that's beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
Get to see that fall color, and it's just now starting to happen, so I'm really getting to enjoy that. It's beautiful.
So tonight we have a very special guest, and her name is Darlene King. Darlene, we'd like to welcome you to our show.
Thank you so much for having me, Bonnie and Misty. I really appreciate the two of you having me on your show.
Well, we're really pleased to have you. And I don't want to mislead people. Darlene is no stranger to me. Darlene is a dear friend to me who lives in the Philadelphia area where I live, and I've had the pleasure of being able to meet her in person and work with her as her book was coming, you know, about her book that was just recently released 2 weeks ago or 3 weeks ago. And Darlene, tell them the exact title of your book.
The book is titled HIV Infected by Her Cheating Pastor Husband, A Wife's Courageous True Story of Betrayal, Survival, and Forgiveness.
Right, and I didn't want to mispronounce one word in that title.
I know, it's very long. It's
it
a title
long,
and
darling.
A subtitle, so.
That's okay. It says what it is. And I asked Darlene if she would do me a favor and be on the show. She was on another show that I have called Books of Excellence, which is my author's co-op, which is not related to this show, and she was such a wonderful guest. And I thought so many of our listeners could really learn from Darlene because of her life experience. And even though it's frightening, and even though this may scare some of you, it's really important that you listen to what she has to say. Because Darlene's story is certainly not a unique one. She's had the courage now to come out with it. But, Darlene, you know that the women who are part of this show are primarily women who have gay husbands. And we know that wasn't necessarily the case with your husband. But a lot of our women have husbands who are in the ministry. And, you know, in some way they're either pastors or they're deacons or they're officers of the church, you know, depending on what the religious denomination is. And it seems like so many of these women are so shocked when they find out that their God-fearing husbands were not that God-fearing when it came to sexual, you know, sexual impropriety and cheating on them, and cheating on them with men, actually. And we hear so many stories, you know, you see on the news that come out about this all the time. So, you know, it certainly does relate, you know, the emotional impact that you're going through to what many of them will have to go through. So maybe you could tell us a little bit about your background and, you know, how your story started.
Well, I'm not shocked, but at the same time, the shock part for me was my husband and I found out that we were HIV positive before we got married. So he went into ministry after we got married. Mm-hmm. And the shocking part for me was once he knew he was HIV positive, that he continued to cheat and continued to infect women without their knowledge and mm-hmm. not use a condom. And that for me was even more shocking than the cheating, and I guess because we had a long history. We've known each other. We knew each other. He has since passed away in 2010, but we had known each other from the time we were kids, 12 years old. So we mm-hmm. went to middle school together. We went to high school together, and we dated off and on for years, but it was always because of him cheating with someone that we broke up. And we got back together at the 10-year high school class reunion, you know, and we started dating, and that's around the time that we started dating really seriously. And that is also the period that I believe that we were HIV infected. And he wasn't able to really determine who were the women. He had slept with so many women that he wasn't able to determine the women he had slept with to be able to pinpoint how he was infected. But the what basically happens is when you're, in my case, what happened was I found out because I gave blood to the uh-huh. Red Cross. And when I gave blood, the blood tested positive, and they sent me a letter, and the letter basically was a long letter stating your blood tested positive, you can no longer give blood, you have been placed on the list. So it was a shock because at that point we weren't dating because we had broke up because he was cheating. So, you
know. Now, also, let's discuss what year this took place.
I found out 1991. It was 1991.
Just to give people a perspective in case they've forgotten, in 1991, it was very rare for anybody to survive HIV or AIDS, correct?
That is true. That is true.
And so this was very shocking, startling news to you back then, right?
It was very shocking, and I was convinced that I was going to die. That
Which
was
not
a fear of mine.
Not an unrealistic thought, considering how many people really did die back then.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So that was my biggest fear. I was previously married, so I had small children. I
uh-huh.
had a 9-month-old baby and a 5-year-old. Now, thankfully, they tested negative. And
uh-huh.
I had, you know, what they tell you to do in the letter is, all your previous partners have to be tested, which was basically him and the children's father. They tested negative, and he tested positive. So that's how we were able to determine, you know, where I got it from. But he was never able to determine it from not using condoms and just sleeping with so many women. But I really had this false sense of HIV would be that factor that would stop the cheating.
Uh-huh.
I guess for me, it was inconceivable that you would cheat with HIV. I don't know how to describe it. I guess was very naive in thinking that that would stop a person who was a habitual cheater.
Uh-huh.
But it didn't.
No, and also he was constantly lying about it, right?
Oh, he lied constantly.
Uh-huh.
You know, I was actually thinking today as I was, you know, I didn't know the questions we were going to talk about, but I started thinking today, there not only did he lie constantly, and we broke up and get back together, and broke up and get back together, even after we were married, we break up, get back together, break up, get back together. But I started thinking about all these women would call my house. And it was almost like you wanted to get caught,
uh-huh.
but you also wanted to have this perfect family image in order to pursue this goal, this dream of going into ministry and becoming a pastor, which in hindsight, I see this as a goal and a dream that he had and something that he was wanted to pursue. And to do that, I believe he felt in his mind, and I can only do this, of course, from hindsight, but I believe he felt in his mind he had to have this show of the perfect family image, the wife and the children, and, you know, everything is perfect here in my home. So, therefore, I'm, you know, this perfect candidate to become a minister and to soon become a pastor. And, but when I think back to all the cheating, most of the cheating I found out about was people calling my house. Why would you give people your home phone number? I don't know why that came to me today. I thought about that. I thought about all the phone calls, and they would call and hang up. If I answered, they'd hang up. He answer, he'd talk. I'd say, who's on the phone? Nobody, just somebody, a friend. You know, you get those signals. I mean, as women, we know there are just certain signals, there are just certain signs that we get that we know. And you cut me off. Feel free to cut me off, Bonnie, if I talk too long. But
well, you're
one of those
absolutely right.
You know, one of those signals that I talk about in the book was the one woman that he was cheating with, and our youngest son played basketball with him, so he spent the weekends with us, and by him working the night and the weekend shift, I pretty much had the kids, ran the kids back and forth to the basketball games and the little peewee games. It was just a little kiddie game, but I had the kids, so when he would spend the weekends, I basically babysit it. But when then he would go to church with us, and then Sunday come, and when church was over, we'd go home and we'd drop him off. And this happened a lot of weekends. This particular weekend, we pull up to the house, and she walks to the car, and it's just a look. It's a look in her eyes. And as she's standing there at the door, outside of the car, on his side of the car, he's driving, and she's looking at him, and he's looking at her, and I knew it. It wasn't like they said anything. I just knew it. It's an instinct, and I don't know if it's from years of him being caught or just the guilt. I don't know what it was. I don't know what it was that made me look at him and look at her and say they were sleeping together. And it turns out they were.
Isn't that amazing?
You know, and we broke up again, but we did get back together. And, you know, it's always the promise of, I love you, I'm never going to do it again, I've always loved you. I mean, that's the story that I heard over and over again. I love you, I want to be with you. Please, you know, it's never going to happen again. And we moved, and that is at the point in which we started a ministry in Delaware, and he became the pastor. And I really did believe that, okay, after that fiasco, this is it. I know we're on the right path. This is the exact path that we're supposed to be on. This cheating is over. This cheating is done with. Wasn't done. All the old signs, all the old patterns, you know,
now,
start back up again.
What really pushed your husband into the ministry? Because when you met him, the two of you were not really into that part of life, right?
Well, we were very involved. Once we found out that we were HIV positive, that really pushed us. Both of us, I believe, back into ministry and closer to God. I mean, when you have that aspect of fear of death, that's exactly what happens. For me, anyway. For me, it drew me closer to God. But my feeling then was it was drawing both of us closer. And then we went full-fledged into working in all different aspects of the church, not as a minister or a pastor at that point, but just working in ministry, doing things with kids and with youth and all kinds of activities and programs.
So you found yourselves both back in the ministry. You were married. You were the pastor's wife. And that didn't seem to mean a lot to a lot of women.
I wasn't the pastor's
right?
wife at our old church. So, no,
right.
at that point, we were just in ministry. We didn't go into our own ministry until we moved to Delaware. After that last fiasco with the whole having me babysit while he was cheating with, you know, her, I'm babysitting on the weekends and he's cheating on the weekends. That one was a doozy. I mean,
well,
that was,
you know,
like,
also, it just was amazing to me when I read your book to see how some women had no regard to the fact that your husband was a married man in the ministry, right?
No. Because she,
you know, in other words, it didn't faze them that, you know, he was.
Because at that point he was a minister. And, yeah, she knew he was a minister. She knew he was married.
But I'm saying
because
there are other women as well, correct?
I can't say for sure with other women because
mm-hmm.
I didn't get to talk to everyone because, like I said, people would call and hang up when I would answer the phone because the first words out of my mouth, if they stayed on there long enough, they
uh-huh.
heard HIV if they stayed on the phone long enough to talk to me. Because that was my first question, which was my
mm-hmm.
first question to that particular young lady. You know, when once we had the conversation and I insisted he was cheating and he insisted he wasn't, he must have told her because she then called me and said they were going to be together and he was leaving me. And I told her she could have him, but did you know that he was HIV positive? And she
mm-hmm.
didn't know. So he never told her. So...
And did she believe you?
No, she didn't believe me. She called me back a couple of days later, and she told
mm-hmm.
me I was lying. And I told her, I said, you know, if you feel as though I'm lying, that's fine. That's the point in which I told her. I said, you can have them. I said, but please just make sure you get yourself tested in 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
And she didn't believe me. He never told her, and then when I told her, he lied, and he told her otherwise.
And, you
know, he called
me
and said it.
Your ex-husband had the perfect, you know, sociopathic personality, and I think he fits into a lot of the different descriptions of sociopaths. But, I mean, here's somebody who would blatantly lie to you, correct? Look you in the face. And tell you that you're mistaken. Like when you told him that, you know, he must have infected you. What did he say to you then?
Well, back then we pretty much knew, because once we had the test and everybody was tested. Once everybody was tested back then, he knew.
Mm-hmm.
But we just attributed to both of our, you know, indiscretions. We weren't married at the time, so
mm-hmm.
we just attributed to. I never knew that he had had until he confessed to the number of partners that he had years later that he had been with so many people. You know, he just made it seem like, oh, well, it must have come from, you know, one of the girls that I've been with at one point in time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but he couldn't pinpoint, you know, what girl. So... At that point, it was just really accepting the fact, okay, you know, the talk was, we have it, there's nothing we can do about it, we can't change it, now we're, you know, where do we go from here? And his
mm-hmm.
whole thing was, I love you, I always love you, you're the love of my life, you've always been the love of my life, let's get married. We'll be there for one another when we get sick, you know. We'll be there to take care of one another. It was a commitment to take care of one another and be there for one another. And I was believed in this commitment. I believed in the commitment. I believed in the commitment to marriage. I believed
uh-huh.
that we were on the same page. And I truly believe that the cheating would stop just because of this disease alone, that was enough to cease any cheating, that it would
uh-huh.
exist, it would no longer exist. So
that wasn't the
that it never stopped.
Uh-huh.
In all those years. Because you think that's years from 1991 until I finally left, which was September 5th, 2003. That's a pretty long stretch.
It was
of cheating
and
countless number of women being infected and not knowing it. And I know he didn't use condoms because, you know, that same woman before, you know, also said that she might be pregnant. So then now that right there says you're not using condoms, because if she thinks that she's pregnant, well, then you couldn't have been using condoms if she thinks she's pregnant. And I would always try to insist that we use condoms, because the doctor actually suggested that even though we're positive, that we should still continue to use condoms. And he just refused to use condoms. I don't want to use condoms. And he refused to use them. So if you're refusing to use them with your wife, I can't see someone agreeing to use them with someone else.
Well, one of the important, you know, there's so many beautiful things you write in your book, and, you know, some of them are, you know, kind of humorous, too, because, you know, these are lies that our husbands always tell us. But, for instance, you have a section here, interesting questions and answers over many years. So the question, you are the pastor, how can you be going to strip clubs? And his answer was, I am an undercover agent for the FBI and DEA. My friend, who was a cop, knew I had street cred, so I had to go for him because he would be identified.
They sent him in because he had street cred. Now, I have to admit, today I laugh.
Mm-hmm.
Back then, I wasn't laughing.
Were you believing it, though?
Absolutely. Did I believe it? No, absolutely not. But I was just so frustrated. I was so frustrated and so tired. But at the same time, I was really committed to making this marriage work. And I was also, I had this belief that when you get caught in such a big manner, like in that manner with the whole thing with the having me babysit, to me that was a big blow up. I'm thinking, when you get caught big time like that, cheating is going to be over. No way anybody's going to cheat. I've just got caught big time. I've almost lost my marriage. There's no way in the world I'm going to go do this again. Now that's my thinking. Clearly that wasn't his thinking. So because he wasn't caught by me, he was caught by someone else, and it traveled, and it actually traveled, unfortunately, through the children. The children is the one, friends of the children found out that it was a rumor. It went back to the children, made its way back to me. I confronted him, and I think he knew that the rumor was out there, and it was almost like he had been preparing what was going to be his response. But an undercover agent for the FBI and the DEA, and they sent me in because I have street cred. I was just, I can't even remember how I responded, but I think I, like, threw my arms up in the air and was just like, you know, are you kidding me?
Well,
you
then
know,
he said, where is your paycheck for the undercover work with the FBI and DEA?
That actually came at, it's like I said, conversations over time, because all this crazy stuff happened, did not all happen at the same time. Because what would happen is we would get into discussions about money. Money was always a topic because everything was joint. Our accounts were joint. So I was responsible for paying all the bills, paying the mortgage, paying this and that and that. So, you know, I'm trying to figure out, well, what are we doing with this? We have to budget. Everything has to be budgeted. And so when things aren't adding up and I'm not able to budget and I'm not able to pay this, you know, so my thing was, well, okay, well, you're an undercover agent, even though I know good and well he's not an undercover agent. I'm like, well, where's your money from your undercover work? You know? No, and well, you have, there was no money from any undercover work.
And then you write in your book, no, run, run, please run.
That was the section on run. I mean, it was like there was just so many crazy stories. That's also the same section. And this lady I never got to talk to, so I didn't get to tell her the words HIV. But that was the same section where he went out with somebody and he left her a voicemail message. And he leaves this voicemail message, and in the message he's going on, and I can't remember verbatim exactly what he says, but the message goes in the lines of, you know, I love you, I had a great time last night, I hope to see you again, and he's just like going on and on in this message that he's leaving on her answer machine.
Uh-huh.
He changes her answer machine to the message that he left. Then she began to call my house phone. Now, this is what I'm talking about. I started thinking about that today. Well, I started thinking, why would you give someone your house phone number? You're married. Why are you giving out? It's bad enough that you're cheating, and, you know, there's no justification for that. But to give out your house phone, it's almost like I want two worlds. I want this perfect family so that I can continue to pursue these goals and achievements that I want to do in this quest to become the pastor. But at the same time, I want this other life full of extramarital affairs.
Right. So, well, here in your book it says, you know, you said the question to him, this woman keeps calling my house. I pressed *69 and called her house back. Guess what happened? Her answering service is a message you left on her machine. It appears that you have found a good and crazy one this time around. She has changed her answering machine to your voice with a message you left saying you love her and you had a really good time. You want to hear it? And his answer was, no, I didn't. I wasn't with no women. And you said, well, you're sure you don't want to hear this? And he responds, he calls the number and listens to the message. Question, I thought you didn't know her. His answer was, I can't believe she did that. She's trying to set me up. I just said that because I want her to feel good about herself. I never even met her. Okay, I did meet her, but it wasn't anything. I can't believe she did that. I'm so sorry. I'll never do that again. And you said, did you tell her you were HIV positive? And he said, no. And you said, why would you want to get someone pregnant? The answer is because you won't have a baby. And you said, have you lost your mind? Why would I purposely give my baby HIV? He said, that doesn't mean anything. You could have a baby if you wanted to. And like you said, it was the stupidest thing I ever heard. I had no response. I just walked out of the room shaking my head. Believe it or not, I asked again numerous times to have a baby. I was asked again numerous times. Ridiculous. I just wanted to smack him. And you said, run, run, run.
Yes. That's the only advice that I can give is if this is happening to you over and over and over again, run. But now, today, that I look at it, I believe I was supposed to stay to go through all these humiliations to really be able to talk to, relate, and help women who are going through the same thing, especially people living with HIV and AIDS, to be able to talk to them from a standpoint of where I've been through. Because if I had gave up years ago, all the different people that I meet in the hospitals, in the doctor's office, on the buses, on the corners, I wouldn't have a chance to talk to people about all the crazy things and try to help them who's finding themselves in these same crazy situations. Because for a long time, I thought I was the only one. I'm thinking there's absolutely no way in the world that there's another man out there in the world that can be doing the kind of things that my husband did. I wouldn't have believed that there would be anybody else that could exist that would do these things.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm finding out the hard way. The more and more I talk to people, after writing after reading and so many people that I've talked to, that I wasn't alone.
No, not by a long shot. And that's why we always tell our women, you must get tested. You know,
absolutely.
Once you find out that your husband has had an extramarital affair, regardless of who it's with, because we not only have women listening to the show, I mean, most of our women are married to gay men. Some women are married to men who identify themselves as bisexual. But some other women even have husbands who are sex addicts. So they're having sex with anyone and everyone, man, woman, and everything in between. And, you know, they think, well, I haven't slept with him lately. Well, how lately is lately, Darlene?
Well, one of the things when we've talked about in some of the AIDS agencies is getting tested every 6 months. If you think that you have been in a compromised situation where you could have possibly contracted the disease, get yourself tested.
How long period is the, you know, should somebody be tested?
I believe if you are, this is my own feelings. I believe if you're sexually active, you should, on a regular basis, get tested. If you are sexually active and you are not using condoms and you are not protecting yourself, you should just make it a habit on a regular basis every year. Just get tested. It's not going to hurt. It's not going to hurt. There are so many different groups and so many different agencies now that do free, anonymous testing. And I think the reason why the disease is spreading as fast as it is because people are not being tested. And, you know, you mentioned, you know, different, all the different sexual orientations of different people. It really doesn't matter. It's anyone who is sexually active, because even if you are sexually active and you're with an individual, and you'll say, I have complete trust in him or her, and I don't believe that they are having sex with another individual. You know that little calculation that I do in the book.
Right. I'd like for you to calculate for
you
us
know,
now.
You still don't know, because of the fact that there are times that it can lay dormant and show up a year or so later. It might show up 6 months later. It could show up at another point. We don't know, you know, you don't know when it's going to show up or how long it's going to lay dormant in your system. So, for example, if you're with somebody, but you have been with someone else at some point before you're in your current relationship, and we'll say the two of you are in a relationship and you're completely faithful to one another. It's just the two of you. You're faithful to one another. But both of you have previously had other relationships. Now, the people that you have previously had relationships with, they have also had previous relationships with. So this can travel. When you're sleeping with someone, you are actually sleeping with anyone who they have previously slept with, especially if they're not using a condom, like we said, that they have previously slept with, and that the people who they've slept with have slept with. It can travel its way down the line and then show up later, and you won't know unless you're tested. So you can be in a relationship, so completely faithful, but you've previously had partners.
Right. So what do you figure the calculations are? You had five people, they each had five people.
So I did this calculation, you know, for kids in one of the classes that I had, and I just used five. Well, in my opinion, okay, just thinking back, and I have to be honest, you know I'm very honest in the book about my own promiscuity when I was a teenager and in my young adult years, I use the calculation of five partners. But you think, right now I'm 52. Now, you and I know, because we're friends and we've talked, that I haven't had sex since I left my husband in 2003. But we'll just say a person has five partners. Now, five to me is a low number because you think by the time a person has reached 40 or 50 or even 30, they might have had more than five boyfriends. You know, by the time you reach 30, 35 years old, and especially if you've been sexually active since you were a teenager, you might have had more than five boyfriends. But we'll just use the modest number of five. So if you have two people, that's two, and then each of those two have had five previous partners, that's five for him, five for her, and the two of you, that's now 12. But each of those five had five, that's 25 for him, 25 for her, and the 12, that's 62. So these two people now, just two, they're about to have sex together, and you could potentially be catching a STD from a potential of 62 people just by this one sexual encounter.
And isn't that scary?
It's very scary. And people wonder why I don't have sex.
I
have friends that
say,
I
know, it's really scary.
Oh,
and
Marlene,
like you say in your book, you know, you have two children, two little babies.
Huh?
And you didn't think you'd ever see them grow up back in those days, right?
I did not think I would see my kids grow up, let alone my oldest graduate from college and go back to college and the youngest be in college. You could not have told me that I would live to see this. I was convinced back in 1991 that I was going to die. I didn't think I would see these children graduate from elementary school. I am so thankful and so grateful to have seen the things that I've seen, but even more than me being grateful and thankful, I am thankful that my mom got to see my oldest daughter graduate from college and my youngest daughter and my niece go off to college.
And not
then my
only,
mom, and then she passed.
Survive so that you could see them, right?
Yes.
Because the chances of your surviving back in 1991 were slim to none.
Not only were my chances slim to none, but I was continuously sick. Now, me, I went to my doctors on a regular basis. I took all the medicines that they gave me. I did everything that the doctors told me to do. But my numbers, my CD4 counts, continue to go down, and my viral load continued to go up. And what you want in the ideal situation is the reverse to happen. You want your viral load to go down and hopefully down to undetectable, which basically measures the percentage of virus that is circulating in your bloodstream. So when it's undetectable, that means that the smaller percentage of virus circulating in your bloodstream that they can't even measure it, so they consider it undetectable.
Mm-hmm.
So your CD4, once it goes under 200, they consider that full-blown AIDS. Well, I was down near the 200 mark, and I'm sick over and over and over again. Now I'm still sick. You know, if you read the book, you see how often that I'm sick in all my episodes in the emergency room. I stay in the hospital in the emergency room. But the thing is, the only thing that's different from 2003 and now, with my CD4 counts rising and my viral load going down, the difference is not having sex. That's the only factor that has been removed.
Mm-hmm.
So what does that say? That says that not only was I continuously reinfecting myself as I continued to sleep with my husband, but we don't know who the people were that he slept with and what they may have had. And if they had a strand that was worse than the strand you have, which is possible, that we don't know what their viral loads or CD4 counts were. You don't know. You don't know anything.
No. And
you know, all you know is...
Pretty enough to tell any of them, right?
I don't believe he told anyone. No.
He just kept having unprotected sex.
And then coming home and sleeping with your wife.
Exactly. And, you know, I tell women also, and I think you'll confirm this, Darlene, I mean, the tragedy, you have HIV, AIDS, because, you know, it is a tragedy in itself. But, you know, people get a little too secure today because they see people are living with AIDS. You know, it's not like it used to be when you first contracted it, where it was almost a death sentence for sure. Today, more and more people are living with HIV due to the medications. But the fact remains that, number one, it doesn't mean you're going to have the same quality of life. And number two, there are a lot of other STDs out there. Is that correct?
There are other STDs, and your quality of life is dramatically reduced. I am sick so often that it does not make any sense. Now, one of the things that I have as a result of HIV, and they say it can come from HIV and diabetes, so I probably have a combination, is neuropathy. Neuropathy mm-hmm. sends this nerve pain through all parts of my body. I get it really, really bad in my thighs and in my legs and in my feet. And I get it all over. And I also have neuralgia paresthetica, which is basically like the nerves being pressed and pinched in my groin area. So between the two of them, I get this really bad pain.
Uh-huh.
And just today, I had a long day. I like to be in church. So it was a long day. But my legs went numb, you know. Just a couple of months ago, I was in the hospital with pneumonia. I was in the hospital again. They thought I had asthma. I'm 52. I've never had asthma in my life. I'm making
uh-huh.
this wheezing, breathing sound. I catch every single thing that I come across. You know, even with, you know, a lot of people say or have this fear of being around people with HIV and AIDS. Well, guess what? We're the ones that should have the fear. We're the ones with a compromised immune system. We're the ones that's catching everything that comes along. You get a cold, you're probably going to be cold over your cold in a couple of days. I got a cold, which led to a cough, which led to me having this cough and this problem with my throat for a year. With them trying to figure out what it was, it got so bad that I couldn't hold down any food to the point where after about a month of constantly, and I hope I don't gross out your audience, but constantly vomiting because I just couldn't hold anything down. The moment I coughed, everything came back up.
Uh-huh.
So by the end of the month, I'm completely dehydrated. I can't hold liquids. I can't hold food. I can't hold anything.
And how many times over the years have you been in the hospital, Darlene? It started as
what seemed like a cold.
Right, but I'm saying, how many times through the years have you been in the hospital? Ballpark.
Do you know that I don't even know? I would say between 1991... and now, it's so many times that I actually don't even know. I would have to sit back and try and count. I think it's over 20. It
uh-huh.
may be more. I don't know. I really don't know because it seems like even if I'm not admitted, I'm in the ER
uh-huh.
So often that you know, so there have been so many times that I've been admitted, and there have been so many times that I've been in the ER. And I told you the story. I'm pretty sure I don't have this in the book. But I always joke with my friends. I say, this is how you know that you have been in the hospital too much, is when you go to the doctor's office and the employees at Presbyterian Hospital, which is my hospital, which I love, they think that you're employed there. I was just there a couple of weeks ago, and the guy stops me. He said, you look so familiar. What department do you work in? And I said, I don't work here, sir. I said, I'm a patient. And he said, "Oh, you look familiar." And I didn't go into detail, but to myself I said, "I should look familiar because you look familiar too." That's how often I'm here. If I'm not there for doctor's appointments, I'm there as an admitted patient or I'm there in the ER. That's how often I'm at the place. Your quality of life goes down completely. I would love to be able to get up and go, because I want to be so involved with Action AIDS, and I want to be involved with helping people living with AIDS, and I just want to go. I want to feel like every moment that I have left on this earth is used in a purposeful manner and to be a blessing to somebody else. But if I run one day and then run the second day and then run from sunup to sundown the third day, by the third day, I am completely down. Now, what I've done to myself today, no question about it. It's the pain in my feet and my leg, my thigh going numb in church today, and the spasm started on my back. This is a result of just wanting to have a day of worship. But you things that you love to do, you just can't because it hurts so bad. You know what I mean? Just sitting and standing and walking for long periods of time. And the thing about it is I have to do it because with just the walking, I have to exercise. I have to try to keep myself physically in shape, but I know it's going to cause me pain, and I know at the end of the day it's going to leave me soaking. It's going
to
leave me.
You know, I want to talk to you about something else because I have Misty with us, right, Misty?
Oh, I apologize, Misty.
It's okay, no, I wanted to bring up a question. Are you there, Misty?
I'm here. Yes, I'm here.
Okay, Misty also grew up in an environment of the church. You know, she comes from a family, you know, her ex-husband. What was his connection with the church, Misty?
He was just, church was very, it was just very heavy in their family. It was just a priority in their family.
And which church was it?
He was mostly Baptist.
Mm-hmm. Are you familiar with that at all, Darlene?
Yes, we came from a Baptist background. The church we're at now is non-denominational, and the church that we started that my husband was the pastor of was a Baptist church. But right now the church that we're with now is non-denominational.
Well, you know, the whole thing is, and I don't know if you find this in your church, you know, well, not your specific one, but church in general, since you're a religious person. You know, it seems like Misty can talk a little more about this, the need for people to hide who they are because of religion, right, Misty?
Yeah, absolutely. I've run into that with, of course, my ex-husband and several of the women I've worked with, how they would use religion, and my ex-husband certainly used it against me, to hide behind his own shenanigans and his own shortcomings. He would use religion to bolster him up to look like a better person when actually he wasn't, and I don't think God would expect anyone to stay with someone to do the deeds he was doing. But it's just so interesting how, and I'm not here to bash the church whatsoever, but, you know, you find all different, as you know, if you're involved in any church, you find all different flavors of people there and morals and everything else. And it just, with so many of the women that I've worked with, it just seems so common that oftentimes their husbands would use religion against them, the church against them, in terms of keeping them to stay. Keeping them in the situation and using, you know, some sort of doctrine to, you know, to not get divorced and things like that. I don't know. Have you seen much of that in your experience?
In my experience, definitely. There was a constant conversation between the two of us that, you know, Satan was trying to break up our marriage. Satan doesn't want to see marriages thrive. Satan doesn't want marriages to be together. So that was a constant conversation that we had. But I don't want to mislead people into thinking that this is widespread. This is the small few. You have the small few who makes it so bad for the majority of wonderful, faithful, dedicated pastors and pastors' wives who are working so hard in ministry. And you have that small few that does something so wrong that it shines a light, like we're saying, you know, we came out of a Baptist church and he formed a Baptist church, but at the same time, we came from a wonderful Baptist church.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the church that we came
absolutely
from. And then he started, you know.
There's all types of churches, and it was just a church
types
he was affiliated with, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And I'm not here to give, church a bad name. You know, we're working with a very targeted group of women, you know, body and all, the, you know, the stray wives. And oftentimes, gay men will, for lack of better words, they'll oftentimes hide behind religion. So, you know, even though in the scheme of things, it is a small group of people hiding behind that. You know, when you look at the forest instead of looking at the tree, so to speak. So,
well,
yeah,
I think it's a small group of ministers, maybe. But I think a lot of men do hide behind religion. You know,
mm-hmm.
in the black community, you know, there's a terminology that you're familiar with, I'm sure, Darlene, of down low. And, you know, it was a term that came up, you know, in the, like I say, African, you know, American community for men who were cheating on their wives with men. Are you familiar with that?
Yes. I have read information on it and seen stories on it on television.
Right, and, you know, that's why they said the spread of HIV in the black community was so strong because of the number of men who were, you know, involved with church and other things who were doing these sexual activities but thinking nothing about it, you know, not considering that it was gay. They just said, well, you know, this is just male stuff. But in the meantime, they were bringing home this disease to their wives, and they said that, you know, for a number of years, the growth of HIV in the Afro-American community was like almost double that of other communities.
And the numbers continue to rise. Some of the statistics at a conference that I was at recently, they had shown some CDC statistics, and they were actually older certificate. Statistics that showed that the higher rates of the virus being duplicated was in the African American and Latino communities. So,
well,
you know, that is a statistic in the CDC that has
mm-hmm.
proven that
recent?
We do have a high rate of infection.
Is it recent, that number?
It wasn't a recent number, but the young lady that was given the presentation actually
mm-hmm.
said that she did not have the recent numbers with her at that time, but
mm-hmm.
the current recent numbers is showing that the trend has even worsened.
Wow.
So she talked about that at the conference.
And part of it is once again, you know, these men who, I think in the black community, there's a strong church community. The church is, you know, has a stronghold, you know, on a lot of people. And these men just hide. You know, and they don't consider themselves gay because they have wives and children, but they're having gay sex and bringing home diseases to their wives. So to me, you know, it's all in the name what you call it. I call it gay.
I don't think it's just men who go to church. I think it's men, period, who are on the down low, whether they go to church or they don't go to church. And like in my case, men just cheating on their wives. And the thing about it is, if you're going to cheat and the person you're cheating with know that you are married, well, what is to stop them from also having sex with another individual? They know that you're not exclusively with them. So why should they be exclusively with you? So now
right.
you have a chain of people, which has absolutely nothing to do with the church, but just a chain of people all having sex. No one's getting tested. No one sees a need to get tested, and
uh-huh.
this virus is just continuing to spread because no one is getting tested. And testing is the key, because I think if people, I believe that majority of the people, if they are knowledgeable about their status, I think it would change their sexual behaviors. I do not believe that most people would continue to infect others with this disease if they knew what their status was, and they don't know their status.
I don't know. You know, there are a lot of people out there who just don't care. You know,
some people don't care. I guess I want to have more faith in mankind that they care.
Yes,
I guess,
you do.
You know, I don't believe Bonnie. I'm the only one out there who cares.
You're a much nicer
There's
person
more.
Than
there
I am, I guess.
Be more.
You know, you're not nicer. You're much more idealistic. I think I have to deal with the harsh realities every day of, you know, 50 new women coming to me with all these problems. So, you know, I'm a little jaded on my end.
Which is sad. I mean,
well, you know, the reality is, like I say, we have over 4 million women who are part of our support network.
Oh,
and that's a lot of women,
that's,
you know, who are in this situation, who are husbands are having sex with other men. And, you know, in many cases is unprotected sex and bringing diseases home to their wives, whose lives have now been changed forever, you know, not even having any idea that there's infidelity in the marriage. And in our cases, the husbands aren't being honest about it. You know, they're not telling the wives. You know, they're just continuing to have sexual affairs and not, you know, saying anything. So it's, you know, a very sad situation for the women who are part of our network. You know,
absolutely.
Hopefully it's...
Absolutely,
I don't know if it's better
anyway,
to be honest
with you. It is very sad for any person to knowingly have this disease.
Mm-hmm.
And to have sex with someone and not tell them. I think that is very sad.
I think it's unconscionable, I'm being honest with you. I think people who do that should be held in criminal contempt. I don't know if you feel that way.
And
but I think
there are some states that have, I don't know what all the state, different various state laws are, concerning intentionally infecting women. But I do remember seeing a story, and I'm sorry I don't remember the television show that I was watching, but it was a gentleman, and it was a group of women who had basically followed this man and followed as he continued to have girlfriend after girlfriend after girlfriend. They would get information and contact the girlfriends. And
right,
let the girlfriends
right.
know that he was HIV positive. And eventually he was arrested. I don't remember what state it was, and I don't remember, but I just felt that those were some courageous women. I mean, these women, they became investigators, and they really went out of their way. I don't know if you saw that. Did you see that, Bonnie?
Yes,
on,
I did.
On,
and
on
that was
television?
A number of years ago. And that was one
It was
case.
A number of years ago.
Right, and there were
multiple
women who were infected. But short of hearing it on that one case, I don't recall really hearing it. Have you? Where a man
I don't know of too many legal cases.
Knowingly
no, that's the one legal case that I remember seeing a story about on television, and I just remember thinking to myself, these women are courageous. And I just thought what they did was absolutely amazing. I mean, if there was a way, I have no way of knowing who the people are that my husband infected. But if there was a way that I could investigate and track down these people, I would track them down. I would go door to door with these neuropathy legs that are currently numb, spasm on a heating pad. I would find them, and I would tell them, because the sad part is they don't know.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? They don't feel like, you know, I don't even know, how do we even know if he told them that he was married?
Exactly.
You know. You think about years ago. There have been, you know, and that's something I want to clear up, too, from our last conversation, because I thought about that later. There have been times that I have known people or dated people who told me they weren't married only for me to later find out that they were married. And we broke up, of course, but, you know, still, you know, there are some guys that just don't tell the truth about the fact that they're either dating someone or that they're married.
Uh-huh.
So how do I know? I'll never know. I will never
know. That's the sad part. And that's why, you know, you take the position that you choose to remain celibate, and that's your safest way to do it, right?
Well, it has proved very safe for me. I like my numbers the way they are. My numbers are going in the right direction. I haven't been able to cut down on the pain and the hospitalizations, but I have been able to increase the numbers, and I have been able to live, and I have been able to experience exceedingly abundantly above what I could even ask or think. So I'm thankful.
Mm-hmm. Now, you are an evangelist, right?
Yes, I am.
And you do ministerial work?
Yes.
And you're doing that in Delaware?
In Delaware. Mm-hmm. Our church is in Delaware. And I love it. I love our church. I love our congregation. It's a band of people who basically was formed when our old church was disbanded because they basically, you know, they basically had to kick my husband out because he resigned, and then the next day said, no, I'm not going to resign, and then they just basically said, no, you have to resign. And everything was in his name, so we had to find a new building and basically start all over again. But we started all over again with a wonderful pastor. And he passed away. He's going on home to glory. And his beautiful wife is still a member of our church. I'm still a member of the church, my children, and a lot of the people of that group of people who banded together are still members. And we have a new pastor, and he's wonderful. And his wife, and they're just great. They're great people. But one of the things I love and why I still go there is because of the way that they just really reached out and wrapped their arms around my family and just really tried to help us. They did so much to help us heal. And
you know what?
I'm thankful.
Your ex-husband passed away, correct?
He passed away
in 2000. In what year?
2010.
Oh, he passed away in 2010.
Mm-hmm.
Now, let me just ask you, not ask you, but if you could just mention this, in your early days with HIV, and I think one of the points of your book, and once again it's called HIV Infected by Her Cheating Pastor Husband, and if you go to Amazon.com, you can just put in Darlene King, and you'll see the book come up, and you'll see Darlene standing before the pulpit there, and HIV Infected by Her Cheating Pastor Husband, even if you don't have time to write the name down.
Just a note so that people will know that it's not our church. That was just a location where we were thankful to be able to take pictures. But no, that is not the location of our church.
Okay. Well,
so,
it was a very nice.
So people won't see that location and confuse it and say, oh, I know that church and I know that pastor. No. That is not the case.
Okay, but it is a very nice picture of you from the back, and on the back side of the book is you in the front. But the thing is that even if you can't get this whole name HIV infected by her cheating pastor husband, just write Darlene King in Amazon and you'll see her book come up. But one of the things that really touched me so much in this book, and I think this is one of the points you were trying to get across also, is that, you know, many times people are so afraid of HIV that they treat people with HIV so differently. They're afraid to hug them. They're afraid to be in the same place with them. Can you talk a little bit about that?
I have experienced so many bad experiences in ERs and in hospitals. I have... I share a story about, you know, the way I was treated at this hospital in Germantown one time when I was having chest pains. and they just treated me so nasty. I've had experiences where there have been people that I know that once they found out, they kind of shied away. You don't have proof because no one has come out and actually say the words. But it's almost like when you sense the cheating, you sense the difference in how people treat you and how you feel. And you know the difference. And you know that prior to you revealing you had HIV, they treated you one way. And then after they found out, they treated you another. And it's just a clear contrast that you know that this is the reasons why. Now, there have been times that I've been in the hospitals. Well, uh-huh. They just flat out treated me horrible. You know, some of the hospitals that I have been in, especially out here in Germantown, they have treated me like I was trash that just came in off of the streets.
Right. And you know, I do have to say that back, you know, in the early days of HIV, you know, it was such a horrible, horrible time in this country. And back then, you know, people could be suffering so badly in a hospital and the hospital personnel wouldn't treat them. They wouldn't go in. They were so afraid of getting infected, right?
Well, the sad part about this is the most horrible hospital experience that I had occurred about, I'm taking a guess now because my memory is gone, 3 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
We're in the 2000s now. Now, I understand, I agree with you. Back in the 90s, it was worse.
Mm-hmm.
But now the hospital staff is more educated.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing is, the way I was treated so horrible by these people, I was treated the moment that I came in the door and started calling off my HIV meds.
Uh-huh.
The demeanor of the individual, the nurse who was treating me in the, I guess it's triage when you first come in.
Uh-huh.
So when the way she treated me, she wasn't even at a point where she had to touch me or do anything to me. It was as if I started saying all she wanted to know was my medications, and I'm insisting to her, please call my daughter. But she insisted that I give them to her. Some names I know, some names I don't. I'm on 19 different medications. I don't
uh-huh.
know them all, but I know the HIV meds. I started naming them, and the look on her face was total disgust. Now, you haven't even touched me. You're educated now about this disease. You know that there are ways that you can and cannot catch this disease.
That's so sad.
In 2012. So there's
really
no reason to treat people like that.
Terrible.
And that's why my feeling is, and I think I do say this, and if I haven't said it, I'll say it now. Treat people like that's your mother laying there, or your father, or your sister, or your brother, or your aunt, or your cousin. Picture somebody you love. Place their face on the face of that individual, and then treat them accordingly.
That's a really good way to look at it, Darlene. I'm so sorry that even in this day and age, the ignorance of people, and especially healthcare professionals, because they're educated constantly on this.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
Hmm.
They are.
Unbelievable, treating you with that kind of contempt.
It was contemptible the way they treated me there, but like I said, I have been to...
Did you report it to the hospital?
I did not, and now so many people say, you know, I should have, and I was just so happy to get to my hospital, to get to Presbyterian, with
uh-huh.
my own doctors, and with some people who treated me with love and kindness, that I was
uh-huh.
just so thankful, and I ended up in the hospital for several days after that incident, so I was just so thankful to be back in my home where they think I'm employed, but I'm not. I was just so happy to be back where I belong that I just felt like everyone's going to have to answer for the way that we've done, how we've treated people, and I just want to be able to say that I've loved everybody equally.
Uh-huh. Talk about forgiveness.
That I have loved one another.
Talk about forgiveness for a few minutes before we have to go.
I can just sum it up real quick. I had to forgive my husband. And even for all your listeners and for the women, as hard as it is, you have to forgive. Because when you don't forgive, it turns into bitterness, anger, frustration. It eats away at you. It eats away at you on the inside. Forgiveness became relief, freedom. And when I got to the point, and I came to that point, and I'll tell you quickly, because I had a friend who was struggling with drugs, and I had a past history with drugs, and I began to pray for her. And in the middle of praying for her, I heard as clear as day, and I was crying. Not only was I praying, I was actually crying and weeping and wailing to God on interceding for her to be delivered, because I know she's a wonderful person, and I knew God can deliver, could deliver her. And as clear as day, I heard, "Can you cry for the soul of your ex-husband?" And that day, I cried and I prayed, and I had an opportunity. He called me, because every now and then he would call me, I guess, to see where I was, and as far as this relationship, because we couldn't really talk, or it would lead to an argument. My arguing days are over, but I told him. I forgave him, and I told him previously that I forgave him, but that time I knew without a shadow of a doubt I forgave him, because there was a release inside of me, all that anger, all that bitterness. I'm good. You know, like some people who are just finding out, because the book is out, is like, "Oh my goodness, I got a caller. Is she okay?" I am good. I am in God's hands, and I am good.
Uh-huh.
Spirit.
And once again, it's a matter that, you know, he did a lot of terrible things to you, right? Besides giving you HIV, the way he left you, correct?
But what does holding on to anger, hatred, bitterness, sorrow, depression, who does it destroy? It doesn't destroy him.
Women have to get rid
He's
of it.
No longer here.
Sure. I'm not sure if forgiveness is quite the way to do it, but I do say that acceptance is really the way to do it.
I had to forgive.
Yeah, and that's fine. You know, some women have to, and some women feel better.
I wanted to be forgiven.
Yeah, I say whatever, you know, makes you feel better. It's fine with me. If forgiving makes you feel better, I'm all for it.
Forgiveness was a requirement for me. To move on.
Yeah. Well, you know, also you're religious, right? And that's part of religion.
Yes.
You know,
I was required to forgive
him. It's like God to forgive. You know, if you don't want to forgive, it's okay. But that's coming from me, the Jew. Sorry about that, darling. But you can believe it.
That's okay.
Yeah,
I know I'm required to forgive. And
yeah,
I forgave.
You are. I'm not.
And it is well with my soul.
Yeah, and that's good. And like I said, I just feel that you are just such a wonderful, delightful person to have. Misty, wasn't Darlene wonderful to have on our show?
Absolutely. Very refreshing and such a wonderful perspective, and just what a beautiful view of life. I appreciate it and honored to listen to your story tonight.
Thank you,
yes,
Misty.
Yes, and I know you're
going
to love her book. I'm going to have it sent to you, Misty, because... it was just such a wonderful story, and, you know, there was a lot of laughs in there, right, Darlene? It wasn't
yes.
all
Yes, I'm laughing now.
I was
crying back then, but today I can laugh.
Right, you know, and that's, you know, the great thing about time, being a healer.
Yeah.
And, you know, as I was reading it, there were parts where, I'll tell you one thing about your book, Darlene, It's once you start reading it, you're not going to want to put it down until you finish it. I'm being honest.
That's what so many people are telling me. I am hearing that from so many people that they can't put it down. I've heard that. I'm getting a lot of feedback from that, and I'm thankful that people are enjoying it. But I hope that it helps people to heal, to who have gone through this.
Helps people in so many ways to hear your story because of the fact that, you know, it's such a humanistic story. It's a story of love. It's a story of hope. You know, it's a story where you've seen how many obstacles you've overcome that so many people would just give up. And I'm sure there were times when you really felt like just saying, I can't do this anymore, right?
Oh, absolutely. I am convinced that if I didn't have two children, that I wouldn't be here.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think I would be here. I really don't.
Mm-hmm.
I believe that. When I was going through my depression and seeing the therapist and the psychiatrist, I really only felt at that point in my life that those two children were all I had to live for. That's how I felt at that moment.
Mm-hmm.
And but God has me here for a reason. And I pray that I'm fulfilling my purpose of what he has me here for.
Now, were any of your other family members, were they apprehensive in supporting you through this?
My family is so supportive, you would not believe it.
Mm-hmm.
And not only is my family so supportive, I didn't tell them before I got married that I was HIV positive, and that was one of the reasons why we were getting married. And I'm so sorry I didn't tell them because I was afraid. I didn't know how they were going to take it. I didn't know how they were going to feel. I didn't know how they were going to treat me. I didn't know how they were going to treat him. I just didn't know, and I didn't say anything probably for about a year or so. Once I told them, they became like the army behind me. And the things that have happened to me in the hospitals, I couldn't tell them because there's like a ton of us. There's so many of us that we lose count. When my mom passed away, we tried to count the grands and the great grands. We got up to 40 something and we lost count and we just said 40 something. That's how many it was. And my mom and dad had 9 kids, so between the 9 of us and the 40-something grandkids, I don't think you want to mess with me because my kids will be on the phone calling the entire King clan, and that's how they make me feel. They love me, and they love me unconditionally, and they love me in spite of. And
well, you know what? When you meet
you,
then you know why they
family.
Love you so much, because you are that lovable, Darlene, and I mean it.
Oh, but I want that so much for other AIDS and HIV patients to have families that just hug them and rally around them and support them and not reject them and not deny them and not kick them out and not put them away, but just wrap their arms around them and love them unconditionally in spite of. I want everybody to have a family like mine.
Uh-huh.
And they don't, and it breaks my heart. So I feel like when I find people that don't have anybody to love them, that, you know, I have to love them. God loves them.
You have a big family. They can, you know, spread out a little bit.
Hey, we can. We can. The King clan can spread out.
Oh, my God, with 9 children.
And spread the
all
love
friends.
Throughout Philadelphia.
Plenty
we're
of people
good.
Go around to give other people hugs, for sure.
Some of them are babies. We can't send the babies out yet, but there's enough older ones that we can send out.
You'll have to invite me to one of your family gatherings.
Oh, my goodness. Our family gatherings. And when we were growing up in our house, you would think that it was like a party constantly all the time. There was always so many people. Because you think 9 kids and then everybody had friends. So, you know, if all 9 just had one friend, that's 18 right there. I mean, our house stayed full. You would think it was a party. I don't know how we did it. But that's how it was years ago. People had big families. I come from a family where my mom and dad, their families had big families. There's a ton of us, and I love them all.
Well, Darlene, thank you so much for being our guest tonight, and I hope
thank
that in a few months you'll come back
me.
Again and inspire our listeners some more. And for those people listening tonight and for the future nights when you pick up this broadcast, remember the name is Darlene King. Just go to Amazon, look up Darlene King, and then you'll see her book there. And buy that book if you want to feel good, if you want to have something good to read, if you want something that will inspire you, because that will be the Darlene King book. Darlene, thank you so much for being our
Thanks
guest.
Thanks to both of you for having me. I truly appreciate it so much.
Thank you, and we'll have you back again in a few months, okay?
Okay, love to.
All right, I love you.
Love you too. Have
All right,
a good
night, Darlene.
Good night.
And well wishes and blessings to you, darling. Thank you.
Thank you, and same to you.
All right, bye-bye.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Wasn't that a wonderful guest, Misty?
Absolutely. A little bit of a change, but still very pertinent to the conversations, you know, that we carry on here. It's just so important. I just saw a dear friend. I was gone on my travels with HIV. And, you know, people do. They treat them so differently, just so differently.
It
breaks
and
the heart.
In this day and age, I don't get it.
I don't get it either. You're not going to catch HIV from hugging someone, from touching someone, from showing compassion. And it breaks my heart.
You know, I just can't fathom that in this day and age, if people are still like this, but I guess they are.
People are still afraid of it. And
that's really sad, isn't it?
Yeah, we need to have a show one night on, you know, the safeguards to take, you know, especially with just touch, you know, just the human touch. Everyone needs that human touch, especially when someone's so sick and so just down on their life and their luck and their health, you know, just helps so much what one hug can do for someone.
Mm-hmm. I think that's the lesson that needs to be learned, that,
You know,
you don't run in the other direction. You try to embrace the people who have this illness.
Absolutely.
And like it says, it could be anybody you know. It doesn't have to be just a gay-related situation.
Mm-mm.
It could happen to your friend, to your sister, to your, you know, family, to your mother. You just don't know when this could hit, you know, based on who you're with. So,
mm-hmm.
You know, it can happen to your sister, to your brother, you know. And it's really interesting because I'm updating my previous book, Doom Grooms, which has been out of print, and is going to be reissued next month. And going over it, you know, that was such a really important book. You know, I didn't realize how good that book really was. So
mm-hmm.
I reread it now and did a little bit of updating. But, you know, I was saying that in the beginning, I was talking about AIDS in the book, and I was saying in the very beginning when, you know, AIDS was, first coming out in the 80s, that people used to call it the gay disease. Do you remember that, Misty?
I was really young then. I was still, you know, I was barely in elementary school at that time. But I remember it was just something like, something just to be so afraid of, so feared, so scared of.
But, you know, in the beginning, it was only gay people getting it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why they used to call it the gay disease. And then what happened is that people with hemophilia were getting it, because they were getting blood transfusion, but they figured that those people were getting it from the gay people.
Right.
And then all of a sudden, it wasn't just the gay people, you know, and then some of the famous movie actors were getting it, like Rock Hudson, and people were panicked because, you know, he had just kissed Linda Evans on Dynasty.
I remember that big controversy. I remember that.
Yep, and they were afraid to even go near Linda Evans because she kissed Rock Hudson.
Mm-hmm.
Then, you know, after that, it was that drug addicts were getting it, so they thought, well, AIDS was a disease. Then it wasn't the gay disease. It was a disease for undesirable people, you know,
mm-hmm.
gays, addicts, people sharing needles. But, you know, eventually then it started catching up with other people, you know, and people would bring it home to their family members. But, you know, it was such a dark and terrible time for people who were suffering with that disease. Plus, even though it's a terrible disease to have now, people back then really did not survive it. And it was a horrible death. You know, the way you used to die, I don't know if you remember, people would get lesions all over their body.
Yeah.
And I think the best movie I've ever seen on it was Philadelphia. That starred Tom Hanks and Denzel Washington.
Oh, that was it was a wonderful movie.
Wasn't that a wonderful movie that really, really touched you as far as understanding what people had to go through back then?
Mm-hmm.
And I had lost several friends to AIDS back in the 80s or late 80s. And it was a terrible catastrophe because back then they would go blind. You know, they'd have to be in the hospital suffering terribly in terrible pain. And, you know, there was no medication, there was no relief, and people didn't even want to touch them from the hospital medical personnel.
Right.
It was just very sad, horrible, you know, dark times.
It was traumatic. I mean, I've talked to therapists before that worked during that time, and literally they've suffered from, you know, post-traumatic stress syndrome symptoms just because, you know, of trying to deal with those sort of situations, trying to help, you know, people with AIDS and just, you know, them dying so fast and just so rampant.
It was just
horrible for the, you know, anyone involved in, you know, the caring and people trying to be compassionate to them, you know, just the loss. I mean, because it was just huge losses, huge, because they were just dying so fast.
Terrible. Well,
yeah.
Thankfully, things have gotten so much better today, and with all the medications people have, and I'm not saying that it's not serious, but now they say that you have a better chance of surviving with AIDS than you do with diabetes.
Wow.
So, you know, it's become a chronic illness that can be controlled,
mm-hmm.
and thankfully people aren't dying from it anymore unless they totally neglect themselves. But those people mm-hmm. who take the medication and do what they're supposed to do, but that doesn't mean it's okay to be careless out there and
right.
ignore the fact that this is going to happen, right?
Absolutely. You still have to use protection. And those numbers that she came up with, when you sleep with one person, 60-some people, I mean, that's fascinating. I think people really need to think about that. I've always said, you know, when you sleep with someone, you slept with every person that person has ever slept with. And then you're also sleeping with every person that person has ever slept with, you know, just on and on and on. I mean, it grows exponentially when you start counting it up.
I never thought of it that way. You know,
absolutely.
They slept with five people.
Mm-hmm.
And God, I know I slept with a lot more people than that. I'd hate to be having sex with me and seeing what they're contracting.
And that's a very conservative number. Like she said, five is conservative these days. You know?
Right. Back in the 60s, I think I was sleeping with five people a week. But, you know, times were different then. It was all about sex and rock and roll and drugs.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
I don't think you were born then, but or even conceived
No, I wasn't conceived at that point.
Yeah. I don't even know if your parents are around then. But
they were around. They were probably they may have been dating. I don't even know if they were probably dating maybe hadn't even met at that time. I don't know.
Who knows? Maybe they were high on the beach with me. Who knows?
Maybe. Maybe they were not the people they told me they were. Who knows?
16 or 17. I didn't know what was going on, unfortunately. I said that in my book also. You know, back in those days, you know, when I was 16 or 17, I was living in California, and sex was so rampant. And I can remember, you know, as a 17-year-old girl, you know, having sexual relations with guys. And back then, you know, there was a lot of, you know, gonorrhea and syphilis going around. Of course, there wasn't any AIDS. But you would get a call on the telephone from a guy saying, oh, yeah, I just got back from the clinic and I have to let you know that, you know, I have something. And so you would say, okay, and then you would just go down to the clinic, you know, you didn't even have to make an appointment. You would just go down. And then you would find out, you know, you'd be sitting there waiting for the results. And when they said gonorrhea, like you were so excited that you could just take some pills and get rid of it instead of like syphilis. Little did you know what was to come in the days ahead, Misty.
Absolutely. Scary, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Well, anyway, Misty, I'm glad you're back. You just don't know. We really
thank you, dear. Thank you.
Greatly. But we kept hoping you'd be back by this week, and thank goodness you are. So, Misty, I love you. And
I love you.
I'll be looking forward to talking to you next week on our Straight Wives radio show. Good night to all of our listeners, and you say it first, Misty.
Good night and love to all.
Yeah, we do love you, and we'll be back next week. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.